Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me this morning is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we hope that you'll join our conversation with your questions at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also go online to the UPR website and click on Zesty Garden. And you can email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com or go to Facebook and the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. And you'll notice a posting that just came on at 10 o'clock about today's Zesty Garden. So do your questions or comments there. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's been an interesting season, really wet sometime, but not very hot.
No.
How has that been helpful for berries?
We haven't had seen the sunburn issues that we've seen with berries some years. We've talked about sunburn a little bit in the past. That's a combination of heat and potentially drought stress, where you've got plants that just can't keep up with their respirational demands, and then you get sunburning or bleaching of the drupelets on berries. That's been a little bit less severe this year from what we've seen than past years. But again, it depends on the variety and the soil it's growing in and management.
So my mom asked me this the other day, and I told her what I thought it was. When you have berries that have individual, like on a raspberry, there's only one bump. I don't know, what do you call it?
Drupelet.
It's called a drupelet?
Yes.
Okay. So there'll be only like one or two that are white. Is that from moisture that's been on it, and then the sun, it acts like a magnifying glass and bleaches it?
It can be, yes. That's one of the causes. Some varieties just tend to have drupelets that bleach out like that. It's and particularly among the blackberries, there's some blackberries that are more prone to that, the kind of characteristic. It could be some damage early on in the development that affected the development of that drupelet.
Hmm. Okay.
So the botany lesson for the day is that raspberries, the little drupelets, the individual, it's considered.
Why do they call them drupelets? They don't droop.
Yeah. So I'll explain that. So they're considered an aggregate fruit, which means that the fruit is made up of multiple fruitlets that are fused together. And in the case of raspberries, they're drupes, which is a stone fruit. So a cherry, a plum, a peach, those are stone fruits or drupes. And raspberries are little miniature, like miniature cherries that are all stuck together.
Interesting. I'd never thought of it that
way. So they have a stone in the middle of them, just like every other droop. In the case of raspberries, the stone is the seed, and it's usually small enough that it's not noticeable. One of the criticisms against blackberries is that the stone, is more prominent, and people complain about blackberries, the seeds stick in your teeth or whatever. But that's the stone, just like the cherry pit.
Okay, but they're not really you wouldn't call them a stone fruit. Usually when you say stone fruit, you think of apricots,
right.
You think of peaches.
But the botanical classification for that type of fruit is a droop, and in the case of raspberries and blackberries, it's a drupelet because each of those individuals is a droop.
You learn something new every day. I never thought about that. So in looking at different varieties, so looking at the testing that's been going on over the last 5 years,
about 8 years for some of the studies we've done, we've had tests on raspberries and blackberries both at the farm here in North Logan, just north of campus, as well as at the Kaysville Research Center. We've tested the broader variety trials that we've done have primarily been down at the Kaysville Research Center. So they're pretty typical of conditions along the benches of the Wasatch Front, kind of the typical historical fruit-producing areas along the Wasatch Front.
And what are you trying to accomplish with these trials?
So when I came to Utah State 10 years ago, I was getting a lot of questions about varieties, and I didn't know which varieties were adapted, and nobody had really tested them extensively for a long time. One of my predecessors had back in the 1970s, but there were a lot of new varieties since then.
And you had only anecdotal information pretty much.
And so we went in and planted up some fairly extensive variety trials where each variety was replicated multiple times, and we'd put plots in of, you know, a 20-foot plot of each one replicated. And so we could really get a handle on how well they did. And so we did summer raspberries. We had 20 different varieties of summer raspberries. We did, or I believe 17 varieties, 10 different varieties of fall-bearing red raspberries. And then we put in about 20 different varieties of blackberries.
Mm.
And so the results that we've come up with on the red raspberries, both the summer and fall bears, those have been written up and published. They're available on our website. So if you go to fruit.usu.edu, under berries, it'll say variety recommendations or variety selection or something. And there's fact sheets on each one of those. So you can go there and look, see what kind of yields we have.
On each variety?
On the raspberry varieties. So there's just two fact sheets, one on summer bears, one on fall bears. And it goes through the varieties that we tested, which ones didn't work, which ones we're kind of recommending based on the results that we had. And whenever people ask for a recommendation, it's a tough deal, as you know, because people's growing conditions are different and their preferences are different. So we've tried some varieties that some growers swear by, and in that trial and those conditions, they didn't do as well as some others. And people are looking for different things. If I'm growing fruit to sell it, I want something that's got a reasonably decent shelf life, because I'm going to pick that fruit and I would like to have it stay in good condition for 4 or 5 or 6 or days or a week so that I can get it sold. And so that, if you're doing it for a home garden situation, that's not important. You know, as a home gardener, my berries don't make it back to the house, to be honest with you. They're eaten as I pick them, and maybe some of them make it into the bucket, and the bucket gets cleaned out as I'm walking back to the house. So that's a different situation. And the varieties that you typically see in the grocery store, those have been selected for shelf life. And that's not that important. I would rather have something that just blows me away with flavor and I can let it hang there until it's ready. And then if I want to make jam or jelly or whatever, then yeah, I'll get enough back to the house and process it that afternoon. And I get really amazing. You know, people that haven't grown berries before and haven't experienced that, they have no idea what a raspberry is supposed to taste like, in my opinion, because you can just get such amazing quality if you've got it right there. You're picking it when it's completely ripe and enjoying it right on the spot.
Well, I know when I've gone into the store and I get that little square container that's only it, you know, you've seen them like for blueberries,
right,
they're not very thick, and they have them for raspberries, and they cost an arm and a leg, and I'm sorry, I would much rather wait until these are actually on, because I know those aren't going to taste very good. And I guess if you had some recipe you absolutely had to have raspberries for, they'd be okay.
Yeah.
But yikes, when you've got your own, and you can put in just a few. You don't have to have a whole block of them, do you, for pollinization?
So, no, they're self-fruitful. You don't have to have multiple varieties to cross-pollinate. You don't need a lot to be able to give you the production that you need. I mean, some of the better varieties that we had, we're getting, you know, 4 or 5 pounds of fruit off of a single blackberry plant per season. Now that's scattered out over 3 weeks or so. And you know, for my personal use, and again, I'm not making jam because I can't get back to the house without eating them all, but I have 3 plants of Triple Crown.
Three.
And they're not as productive as they could be because I've got a situation where they're partially shaded in the morning from an ash tree. And then I've had some winter injury each year. I lose some of the canes back. I mean, in Cache Valley,
it's always an iffy situation.
It's an iffy situation. Yeah. You're going to plant the most hardy varieties you can. And even then you'll lose some canes to winter injury. So I could put them in a better spot in my yard and get more production than I do. My personal favorite is the variety that I'm growing. It's Triple Crown. It's one of the more hardy ones. It did very well in our taste test. It was actually number 2 in several of our taste tests that we did.
Does it tend to have, is it more spiny?
It's a thornless variety.
Oh, okay.
So,
that's nice.
And it, one of the characteristics of it is you've got to let it hang there until you think it's past ripe almost before it really tastes good. And the downside is the fruit, by the time it gets to the point where I really want to eat it, it's so soft that you couldn't pick it and hold it for 5 days.
But if you're going to do it for jam,
you know,
that doesn't make any difference.
Yeah. And it's a great one.
Although for pie, that might be an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never been able to pick enough. Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
All right. So looking at your list, I know I've got Chester and I have them on the west side of our of our large shed, I'll call it. Mm-hmm. And the roof slopes down, so any rain that comes drips right off and goes right on top of them. The last couple of years has hardly been any production. Mm-hmm. This year, they're just absolutely loaded. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I cleared a place on the east side of the barn, and there's a willow on to the north of these where I've planted them. So I'm figuring the ones right up next to the fence will get a little bit of shade. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that, and I planted Triple Crown, so I'm hoping that those will have some kind of protection from north winds, the cooler temperatures being situated where they are.
Yeah, so there's, if you can get a little bit of protection, they're going to do a lot better. And in fact, so we've talked a little bit about the types of blackberries that there are, and they're classified by their growth habit. And it's more than just the habit that they grow. It has to do with their genetic background and the climate they're adapted to. So the Chester and Triple Crown, the ones we've been talking about, are considered semi-erect. So they grow, the primacane of it initially grows very upright, and then as it side branches, the branches can kind of flop down onto the ground eventually, especially if you let them grow long enough.
Does the Triple Crown also get really long canes on them?
It will. It'll grow and grow and grow if you don't pinch it. And so we've talked about this in the past as well. The management strategy is you let that primacane grow until it's maybe 5 to 6 feet high, pinch the top off, let it side branch, and then as the branches get more than 3 or 4 feet long, you might pinch those and let them get secondary branching. So it's more shrubby instead of one big long vine that's growing out of your yard and to the neighbor two houses down into their yard. That's not a really good way. So you're basically pinching it back, pinching the growing tip off to force it to branch.
Is it any different from first year plants? Because I haven't pinched mine back yet, but they also haven't gotten really long.
So the first year you want to just let them grow as much as you can, because you're not going to worry about those canes anyway. You're trying to establish a root system in the first year, and that's really what you're after. So the semi-erect types, they're Chester, Triple Crown. There's others out there. Loch Ness is one that we grew in our trials. Hull is another. And those tend to be among the most cold hardy because of the parent material that was originally used to develop those varieties. Then there's the erect types.
Let me back up first. Okay. So zone 5 is what those are supposed to do?
There's a few of them that are classified as zone 4. It's a little bit hard for me to tell. We did some ranking of winter injury for these and looked at the year that we got damage and which ones were damaged the most. And interestingly enough, it had no correlation with the coldest temperature of the year, which is what hardiness zone is based on. Hardiness zone is really the 30-year average coldest temperature of the year. That's what the whole thing is based on. And so we're looking at the data that we have. We've gone out and evaluated cane injury every year on 20 different varieties over 5 years, and there's no correlation with the coldest temperature of the year, but there is correlation with how quickly the temperatures drop in the
fall. I was just going to say, the last couple of years, it seems like we've been having more issues, not with cold in the winter, but going, nice, and then it goes really cold.
Exactly. And so what happens with plants is they need a signal. They need a little bit of cold to signal for them to start to go hardy. And then they need, it's a physiological process. There's reactions that are going on, genes being turned on and turned off in the buds and everything to get those to the hardiness level that they need to be. And if we don't get kind of that conditioning freeze to get them started, and then it gets really cold without any of that, then that's where we see the damage. So we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years, we've probably 2 or 3 times we've seen where it's been a really mild fall in through, say, October. 1 year it was during Thanksgiving week. It got very cold very quickly. That did a lot of damage to blackberries, to peaches, to a lot of things for that same reason. This last year we saw damage because of, again, it happened, same kind of situation, a very mild fall. Never got any real hard freezes until it got into single-digit temperatures in December, and that caused the damage. So the evaluations we've done on hardiness have come out different than other parts of the country, like where they've done a test like this in Minnesota, where it gets bitter cold in the winter. For Utah, at least for the Wasatch Front in northern Utah, that it's not kind of shaken out that way in terms of how they've survived. One thing we did when we put this trial in is we said, look, we don't know what's going to work and what's not going to work. So we included a series of semi-erect types, of erect types, and of trailing types. And they've behaved similar to what we expected. The trailing types were the least consistent from year to year in terms of producing any fruit. Some of them only produced over the course of 4 or 5 years, we'd see fruit 1 or 2 out of those 5 years. Wow. Period. So
I mean, I'm just looking at, like, anyone who's been to the Northwest, Marionberries. Love Marionberries. I'm looking at your list. They only produced, it looks like, in 2 years, and even the 1 year that had great production elsewhere, they've just got like a little scant amount.
A little tiny amount. Because what's happening is you're growing a lot of cane. You're covering the trellis with canes. Then they're all dying back to the ground because of winter injury. Curiously enough, when we did taste tests in a year when we had fruit, some of these trailing types people just loved. They have big fruit. They come on early. You're getting fruit in July on some of these. And the fruit quality is really fantastic.
So which ones are those?
The trailing types. That froze back 4 out of 5 years.
Yeah.
So one of the ones that we did get fruit on, you know, a significant amount of fruit on 3 out of the 5 years, was one called Newberry. It's a trailing type. It was developed partially to replace Marion as a newer variety, and it's grown in the Pacific Northwest. It can be found. It's a new berry. It's a new variety, but it's called Newberry. That of all the ones that we did, that was the most consistent yielder and did better.
But even compared to what I'm looking at here on your graph with Triple Crown, I mean,
sure,
it's only like not even 20% of the production of Triple Crown.
Right. And in general, even in ideal climates, the trailing types, this is yields per plant that you're looking at.
Yeah.
So typically you'd plant those closer together because they're just not as productive on a per plant basis. But the quality is really quite phenomenal.
Well, let's talk about raspberries. We've got about 7 minutes left. Okay. And I'm gonna make sure we get to those.
All right. So We looked at about 10 different varieties of fall bearing raspberries and 16 or 17 of the summer bearers. Let's talk about the summer bearers first of all. So a lot of people that have grown raspberries, you know, that when they think raspberry, they think one name. Canby.
So, oh, those are good.
Yeah.
I like Canby
is a summer bearer.
Those are the old Bear Lake raspberries.
Yeah, that's the old classic Bear Lake. It tends to be, none of the raspberries are particularly nasty in terms of thorns when you compare them to a blackberry, but one of the reasons people like Canby is they tend to be even a little less prickly, a little less thorny than others. And that has done very well. When we did variety trials, it was in the top 4 or 5. People really like it. We had some that did better and have been more consistent. So on our list, if you look at the fact sheet that we have on our website, so the top scoring one for when we did a flavor preference panel, Cascade Delight was one of the top ones.
That's I've got Pacific that one. Northwest. I really like it. Yeah. I really like it.
And not surprisingly, Tulamine was right there with it. Tulamine, if you talk to a raspberry aficionado, Tulamine is the flavor standard for summer raspberries. It's also, of the varieties that we tested, it was probably second to worst in winter survival.
Oh,
so. Most years we got no fruit, or we'd get a few fruit. It was a lot of cane dieback, but it came in near the top. No surprise there. One that came in quite high and is a consistent yielder, which probably most of your listeners have never heard of, is one called Georgia.
Yeah,
and it's a new variety. It when we started testing this, the breeder sent us some material, and it hadn't been selected yet, or released yet as a variety. And it was a consistent yielder. It shows good winter survival. We've done taste tests, both kind of a panel that we put together, as well as consumers coming through the farmers market, and I can tell you more about that, but. Georgia is one that's done quite well, and there is a nursery in California that is now propagating that, and so it is available. I think
you just have to look for it.
Yeah, you're going to have to look. I believe it's Lassen Canyon, which is the nursery that has it, and there may be others. That's the one that I'm familiar with that have Georgia, but Canby did well. So again, coming back to the subjectivity of it all, we had one in there called Royalty, which is a purple raspberry. It's a cross between a red and a black. And you're making a funny face about Royalty. You don't like it.
It's not, I mean, it's not that I didn't like it. It's compared to everything else.
Right.
There and was so much better flavor. I mean, it produced really well. Yeah. It did really well in my garden. But I'm like, why am I growing this? It doesn't.
So I would have to say it's an acquired taste. And what Royalty is it's a cross between a red raspberry and a black raspberry. And people that grew up on black raspberries and love that black cap flavor, they tend to gravitate more to Royalty.
Interesting.
You know, for me, I'm not a black raspberry aficionado by any stretch. And for me, a Royalty is best in a jam. The purple raspberry jam is phenomenal. It's really nice. Eating it off the plant, I don't get all that excited either.
To me, there's no flavor in this. I want something, but I always like bolder flavors, which is why, as we know, in our last couple of minutes, as we move to the fall bearers, which is why I've always adored Caroline since you introduced me to it and I started planting it. My immediate family, we all love it.
Yeah.
My mother thinks they're just so tart. No, I don't want those. Yeah. My dad likes them, but my mom doesn't.
And so I've got the results from that particular taste test, and Caroline came in dead last.
That just blows my mind. They're humongous berries. Yeah. The plants get established really quick. And so if you like bold flavors, plant Caroline. Just ignore what the survey says.
So flavors, there's several components. We've talked a little bit about this in the past, but acids, the acidity is what gives it some complexity to the flavor, not just sugar.
Yeah.
So if you like just sugar, you're going to like a different variety.
See, to me, but just sugar, you got to have something else.
So it's the kind of the sugar acid balance that most people like. And some people like a little more acidity, some like a little less acidity. Yeah. Caroline's going to be more of that bold acid sugar mix that you prefer. And the panel that we had didn't like it as much. They liked higher.
Put me on that panel next time. Yeah.
So the one that scored highest was Anne. Anne is a sweet one. It's
not what I would call just sweet, though. There's some complexity in the flavor to it.
There is.
And I like
it. But it's not a high acid one either.
Right.
It's not got the sourness to it. And that's one that I really like as well. That's the yellow fruited one. It's a little bit late for Cache Valley. Your yields on that one.
This year's been pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had a nice conditions for that. And so it tends to run a little bit later than, you know, the nice part about Caroline is it's one of the early ones. And Joan Jay is even earlier. And I like Joan Jay for flavor, but a lot of people don't like because it's a little bit darker colored fruit. It looks like it's overripe, even though it's not. So,
no, this is great. So I'll have a link on our website as well. Fruit.usu.edu.
Correct.
And we're talking about the taste panels and the trials for blackberries and raspberries. And
we'll have the results up. So you can access the results we have for the summer and fall raspberries. The blackberry results, we're still getting them publication ready. We're hoping to have those up this winter sometime. So by the time you're ordering this spring, you should be able to access those.
Okay. Brent, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and have him in usually every month. This may be the last one until next spring. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens, but thank you for coming in this summer. This is The Zesty Garden, and I'm talking with Grant Carden, USU Extension Soil Specialist, and we're going to talk a little bit about biochar. Explain what that is. It sounds like something to do with, you know, there's biology there. Char sounds like something that's been burned.
Yeah, it is. It is charcoal. Biochar is a byproduct of what we call the pyrolysis of woody materials. And by pyrolysis, we mean that it's used to generate flammable gases, oils, and other things that we use in bioenergy generation. And so it's a fairly emerging material byproduct that we have out of a fairly new energy-related process. So they'll take a woody waste of some sort, you know, cull wood from an old orchard, or, you know, mill waste from a mill or something like that, and they can partially burn it at various temperatures and generate both heat and gases that can be used in you know, diesel engines and other things for generating electricity. So it comes as a byproduct from that bioenergy generation industry, and it's not fully burned or consumed in the process. Most of what we see when we burn wood in the open fire or out in the, you know, the fire pit in the yard or things like that, it's pretty much fully consumed. And so what we're left with is just the ash, which is mostly the mineral material left over from the wood. But biochar has not been completely consumed. And so there's a fair amount of organic matter still left in the material. It looks like charcoal. You'll see it fairly small by the time they get done, you know, preparing it for use as a soil amendment. But it's little tiny chunks of charcoal. We're hopeful that it can be used as a mechanism, as a soil amendment, as a, not just a waste product from that industry, but to be actually introduced to the soil to increase carbon content, to help lock carbon in place in soils and not return back to the atmosphere in the long term. Use it as a resource rather than it just becoming a waste.
Right now, it's just going into a waste stream.
A lot of times it is, and it'll go into landfills or other things, or they'll stockpile it, not knowing what to do with it and things like that. So we're investigating it here at USU and other places around the country, around the world, really, as a potential soil resource for carbon improvement. Now, the research is kind of mixed in terms of result. It depends on what the woody source was and how hot it was pyrolyzed and things like that as to its properties. But we're trying to find optimal properties and optimal wood types and other things to
benefit. So I'm guessing something
like
a cottonwood's not going to do too well, but maybe something a little bit harder wood?
Yeah, well it depends on the properties of the wood and what's in them. I mean, there may be some things that carry over. You know, we have cedar, for instance, that has biocidal properties, or walnut that has herbicidal properties. Mm. So maybe some of those kinds of things may not be very desirable in an eventual charcoal. But we have in this state a lot of orchards and a lot of fruit wood, as old orchards are culled out and new orchards are planted, that we have woody waste streams here in the state that we could maybe use to advantage. So we're looking here at Utah State with cherry wood and some of the others that might be readily available here in the state as a feed source for biochar manufacture.
Would biochar help retain moisture in the soil?
That's one of the advantages that we see. It has it being organic. There are exchange sites on the organic material itself for absorption of moisture and nutrient retention and other things, and we're hoping that can be used to advantage to increase the water holding capacity. What we do notice is that depending on the temperature at which the char is made, it can be a net sink for things like nutrients rather than a supplier or a storage mechanism. So if it's too absorptive, if it's got too much reactivity in the soils, it can actually suppress some of that, and we want to make sure we find the optimal conditions for it. So that's why the research is kind of mixed. We have done some preliminary studies. Brittany Hunter, the Extension Horticulture Agent down in Davis County, is kind of the lead on this and has got quite a few of us here at the university working with her to investigate some of the optimization of that for use in vegetable production. One of the other things that some of the research has alluded to is that because of some of the surface reactivity of the biochar, it does have, on occasion, some suppressive properties for fungal growth in soils. It can attack roots and things like that. So, you know, some of the root rot diseases might be suppressed with the application of this material as well. And so we're looking into that on top of the nutrient and water retention and the long-term carbon storage properties of the material.
Is it somewhat available now if somebody wanted to try it out, or is it still kind of it's in its infancy?
Yeah, it's in its infancy right now. There are some sources in the state where you can find it, but typically not too readily commercially yet. You know, where they might be generating it, you can find often a source to tap into. But yeah, commercially, it's still kind of in its infancy, but we foresee it becoming far more readily available, especially as, you know, folks that are stewardship-minded, organic production and other things might be looking for sources of enrichment for carbon in soils and maybe some of these natural suppressive disease properties that it might have. So,
what are the advantages for soils, say, in the Intermountain West that tend to be drier and higher in pH?
Well, you know, we're always at a deficit for moisture. We're always at a deficit for organic material in soils. Organic materials, even though they're important, we really only have about, natively anyway, in our soils, anywhere from 0.5% to 1.5% by weight organic matter. And, you know,
it's pretty low.
You look at some soil, you look at some soils in the Midwest and Eastern seaboard where you're looking at, you know, 10%, you know, we really suffer for want of organic material in our soils because of this, the moisture retention, nutrient retention properties that it potentially has. And so we are always looking for ways of improving that in our Western soils, and this might be a really good opportunity for that. pH, you know, organic materials tend to be a little more on the acidic side in terms of pH. These materials oftentimes are fairly neutral to alkaline even in their pH, but increased organic matter over time can have an effect to lower pH in soils. The problem we experience here, and that we just have so many constituents in our soil that buffer pH at an alkaline level that it's hard to get rid of all of that in order to reduce pH in our soil. So, but increased organic matter over time will help address the issues that high pH can cause, like a reduction in nutrient availability, a reduction in root growth and the structure of the soil and things like that that we're missing because of the lack of organic matter.
Yeah. Sounds like it's not going to hurt the soil. It can only do good.
It can, unless it becomes a sink like we talked about. And we want to avoid those conditions where that happens. But it's a potentially really good resource, and that's why we're doing some investigation with it.
Great. Well, I've been talking with Grant Carden, USU Extension Soil Specialist, about biochar. Thanks for coming in, Grant.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next is a conversation about tomatoes. And before we get to that, though, I wanted to make a quick mention of something happening this Saturday at Thanksgiving Point. The Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers Association is having their weigh off. And if you'd like to take your pumpkin down to have it weighed, and these buggers, some of them are up to like 1,800 pounds. They're pretty good size. Take it down there. The information is on their website at Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers. And they're also doing a contest for long gourds and weigh-offs for giant tomatoes and watermelons. So, again, this is the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers having their weigh-off at Thanksgiving Point this Saturday. And check-in and registration begins at 8 o'clock in the morning. The Zesty Garden and our Yes You Can segment. I'm the host, Brian Earle, and with me is Adri Roberts, who's USU's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences agent in Cache County. And today we're going to talk about tomatoes and specifically why over the last decade or so we've had to add more acid to tomatoes. Because it used to be, you know, when my grandma did her tomatoes, we never had to add that much acid. But the tomatoes are changing. They're not nearly, they don't have as much acid.
Right. We're breeding them so they taste better fresh. We're eating more fruits and vegetables as a nation, as a society. And so we, the breeders are working on trying to make them taste better, less bitter, less tart, just less acidy. And so they're bred to taste that way fresh. But the unfortunate thing is they're not as safe when you can them. So it's important that you add a little acid to your bottles every time that you're canning to make sure that that acid is in there to bottle them safely.
Now, are you talking citric acid? Are you talking about lemon juice?
Does it matter?
Okay, either one works.
Either one works, right. So if you're using lemon juice, you're going to add 2 tablespoons of lemon juice per quart. Or 1 tablespoon of lemon juice per pint. If you want to use citric acid, it's 1/4 teaspoon per pint and then 1/2 teaspoon per quart.
Does it change the flavor?
We have tested in my office with interns and we did it and we prefer the lemon juice. In fact, we quite like that tomato juice with that, or tomatoes with the lemon juice. It's not bad at all, we think. The vinegar is another alternative you can use, and it definitely changes the flavor. So we highly recommend that you'd use not vinegar, but more like lemon juice or the citric acid.
And lemon juice is fairly inexpensive.
Right.
You can get it in quart bottles, basically, and we go through it like crazy and then have it throughout the rest of the year, whatever's left over, to add to our water or something. So,
right.
If you were growing heirloom tomatoes, are there tested recipes so you wouldn't have to add the extra acid?
Not really. Since we really don't know, we recommend that you do it with all of them. All of your tomatoes. Now, if you're making a salsa and you're using an approved recipe for salsa, then it has added lemon juice, added vinegar, and they're fine. You don't have to add any more than the recipe states. But if you're not using a USDA or a bulk canning company recipe, then you need to be careful because it could be problems.
Have you seen or heard of anything where there have been problems because there wasn't enough acid in there?
I've tested. I do a pH test in my office of some questionable ones. People call and say, you know, I'm using a homemade recipe, and I'll say, well, I can test the pH, and then we can go from there. The pH has to be below 4.6, or it raises a red flag that it could be trouble, and I have tested a few. It doesn't happen very often, but I have tested a few. We were testing some recipes in my office a few weeks ago with my interns, and we felt like a recipe was a little too vinegary, and so I tested the pH on it, and it was just a little borderline questionable. So we added more tomatoes, and surprisingly, that brought the pH down. So they were fairly high acid tomatoes that they were helping that recipe out. But of course, I have the advantage of being able to test the pH, but we do it in our office if there is a question.
Well, and that's what Extension is all about, is being able to help the public. So, I mean, call your office or wherever you happen to be in the state, call your county Extension office, and someone is going to be there to be able to help out.
Right, right.
The last word we can have in here is make sure only to use tested recipes, I think.
That's right. And if you're bottling tomatoes, please add some lemon juice.
And then the pressure cooker, these need to be done in a pressure cooker, or can they be done in a water bath?
We highly recommend the pressure canner because it's a higher temperature for those tomatoes. However, we do have canning times for the boiling water bath, and they're really long because of that, to make up for that safety factor. And so depending on how you prepare your tomatoes, it could be up to 95 minutes you're going to process those. I personally crush my tomatoes, and then I can get away with 55 minutes for quarts. But I make sure I add that lemon juice.
And you can put a lot more tomatoes in the jar when they're crushed like that.
Right.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about why to add acid to your tomatoes. And Adri Roberts is USU's Cache County Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. Thanks for coming in, Adri.
You bet. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Good morning. I'm glad you're here with me today because we're going to talk about that thing that is absolutely driving us all batty, although we love it this time of year, which is tomato explosions in our garden. My tomatoes are just going gangbusters out there, and they're all temperamental beauties. They're all heirlooms, and they're just not ever stopping, and they're fabulous. And so I look for things to do with them. And when I do that, I turn to one of my favorite authors who wrote about food in More Home Cooking, subtitle A Writer Returns to the Kitchen, and her name is Lori Colwin. She has a whole chapter on tomatoes, and I thought I would just share that with you today because it sings to my heart. So here we go. Lori writes, "There are very few things mankind can't live without. For centuries, we survived without compact discs, automated bank tellers, iceberg lettuce, and bubblegum-flavored toothpaste, to say nothing of the internal combustion engine. But life as we know it would be unimaginable without the tomato. Half of our soups, pasta sauces, and pizzas would vanish. No gazpacho, no ketchup. Our stews would lose their snap, our chili would fall flat. Every time you turn around, the tomato is giving its wonderful flavor to something. How empty our grocery shelves would be without pureed tomatoes. Tomato paste in cans and tubes, sun-dried tomatoes, tomato soup, tomato juice, and the imported crushed tomatoes that come in those little boxes. One of the joys of summer is to go roaming through your garden, pulling ripe tomatoes off the vine and biting in. Juice and seeds drip all over your nice white shirt, but who cares? In summer, the idea is to eat as many tomatoes as you can and enjoy the luxury of getting sick of them. When September rolls around, they have become a little woolly and somewhat less flavorsome. Then it's time to lay in a big supply of canned tomatoes, store-bought or homemade, to take you through the winter. A world without tomatoes is like a string quartet without violins. My own idea of pure bliss is a tomato sandwich, which is good on any kind of bread, from grainy imported Vollkornbrot to suave, textureless semolina. This sandwich can only be made with ripe tomatoes, luscious and full of seeds. The bread is slathered with mayonnaise, then dusted with celery salt, and layered with thinly sliced tomatoes. I prefer this sandwich open, but it's fine with a lid. My favorite salad is the ubiquitous salad of the Middle East. Diced cucumber, onion, and tomato dressed with salt, pepper, olive oil, and lemon juice. If you fry up some squares of pita bread in olive oil and add some flat-leaf parsley and a little fresh mint, you have a salad called fatoche, which is ridiculously delicious and extremely simple to make. This salad, with or without bread, is my summer staple. I often make a large batch, eat it all for lunch myself, and then have to compose another batch for dinner. The tomato, summer and winter, is everyone's friend. The world's easiest and quickest pasta sauce can be made with fresh tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, or drained canned tomatoes, which you dice and sauté in olive oil with minced garlic and hot red pepper flakes. This takes less than 10 minutes and always tastes good. With freshly grated cheese, you can't ask for anything better. I've never yet encountered tomatoes in any form unloved by me. Often at night, I find myself ruminating about two previously mysterious tomato dishes, which I was brazen enough to get the recipes for. One is tomato pie, and it's a staple of a tea shop owned by Mary O'Brien in Salisbury, Connecticut. According to Mary, the original recipe was found in a cookbook put out by the nearby Hotchkiss School, but she has changed it sufficiently to claim it as her own. The pie has a double biscuit dough crust made by blending 2 cups of flour, 1 stick butter, 4 teaspoons baking powder, and approximately 3/4 cup of milk. Just a regular biscuit dough, either by hand or in a food processor. You roll out half the dough on a floured surface and line a 9-inch pie plate with it. Then you add the tomatoes. Mary makes this pie year-round and uses first-quality canned tomatoes, but at this time of the year, 2 pounds of peeled fresh tomatoes are fine, too. Drain well and slice thin 2 28-ounce cans of plum tomatoes. Then lay the slices over the crust and scatter them with chopped basil, chives, or scallions, depending on their availability and your mood. Then grate 1.5 cups of sharp cheddar cheese and sprinkle 1 cup of it on top of the tomatoes. Then over that, drizzle 1/2 cup of mayonnaise that's been thinned with 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, and top everything with the rest of the grated cheddar. Roll out the remaining biscuit dough, fit it over the filling, and pinch the edges of the dough together to seal them. Cut a few steam vents in the top crust and bake that pie at 400 degrees Fahrenheit for about 25 minutes. The secret of this pie, according to Mary, is to reheat it before serving, which, among other things, ensures that the cheese is soft and gooey. She usually bakes it early in the morning and then reheats it in the evening in a 350-degree oven until it's hot. It's hard to describe how delicious this is, especially on a hot day with a glass of magnificent iced tea in a beautiful setting, but it would doubtless be just as scrumptious on a cold day in your warm kitchen with a cup of coffee. The other tomato concoction has no name. I had it at a very fancy buffet as a side dish. Whatever it was, I tried not to disgrace myself by eating enormous quantities of it, but I was not very successful. I just couldn't get enough. Finally, I snagged a waiter and begged him to tell me what was in it. Apparently, you take numerous cans of plum tomatoes, drain the tomatoes, put them all into a large roasting pan, drizzle them with olive oil, and sprinkle them with chopped garlic. You then bake this in a moderate oven for a very long time. The waiter was unclear about how long, but he did say you had to stir it once every 30 minutes to get the brown parts mixed in with the rest. This might be a good thing to try on a winter's day when you have no intention of leaving the house and have invited a couple of worthy friends to come for dinner. It would also be heaven on a wet summer evening, served hot or cold. With a loaf of bread and a bean salad, this makes a dinner I would walk through fire for. My daughter has a book called Little Dog Dreaming, the story of a city dog who gets to go to the country for the summer and spends the winter lying on various chairs and sofas, dreaming and dreaming about the exact spot in which he has buried his bone. I spend my winter daydreaming about the exact bowl I am going to make my first summer tomato salad in, and about how I will not feel the slightest twinge of remorse if I buy the last two bags of tomatoes at the organic farm stand. A nicer person would leave a bag for someone else. I have been known to open one of those bags in the car and eat most of it without sharing on the way home. These are the sorts of deep, primitive feelings inspired by tomatoes, and I am convinced that there are millions of citizens out there just like me. On one of the great days of my life, a friend with an enormous garden invited me and a pal to wander through his tomato patch and take as many plump specimens as we wanted. It was the end of the summer, and he had overplanted. I felt like the person in the Andrew Marshall poem, The Garden, about whose head ripe apples fall, except that these were tomatoes. In this case, sharp, ripe, juicy cherry tomatoes. In this world of uncertainty and woe, one thing remains unchanged. Fresh, canned, pureed, dried, salted, sliced, and served with sugar and cream or pressed into juice, the tomato is reliable, friendly, and delicious. We would be nothing without it. And that is what Lori Colwin has to say about tomatoes. One of my favorite pieces of advice about keeping tomatoes came from Lynn Rosetto Casper when I met her, to my great good fortune, in southern Utah a few years ago. She's written a wonderful cookbook called How to Eat Supper, and she is the woman who does the UPR program Splendid Table. And she has written this about roasting vegetables. She was the one who told me the best thing to do with ripe tomatoes, if you had too many of them, was not to can them, but actually to roast them. And she told me how to do it. It sounded quite a lot like what Lori Colwin recommended. Lynn said you just take your biggest tomatoes, all different varieties, not stick with anything. You fill up a half sheet pan, which is the biggest sheet pan that you have that has edges. Put a little olive oil down on the bottom of it, and then just take slabs of your tomatoes, 3/4 to an inch thick, and lay them down, cram them in there. Sprinkle a little balsamic vinegar over the top and salt and pepper, and put them in a 450-degree oven. I usually set my timer for 30 minutes. Before the 30 minutes is up, your house is going to smell like a good Italian restaurant. But at the 30 minutes, if your tomatoes aren't too juicy, you need to check them before that, and you can kind of smell them. You want them to start caramelizing. You want the juice to get a little bit browned and caramelized around them, and then you stir them together. When you stir them together, then they're a beautiful paste. If you are not fond of seeds or little pieces of tomato skin in there, you can strain it when it's cool. I don't mind those, so I just leave it in there. When I stir them the first time, I kind of judge how much longer they need to roast. I snip a little fresh basil in there and put them back in to roast for another 10 or 15 minutes until they really are the consistency of a nice tomato sauce. And then I take it out, and when it cools down, I pop it into Ziploc bags and freeze it. It's a quick and wonderful thing to do. No canners are involved, and your house smells fabulous. What's not to like? So that really is what Lynn Rosetto Casper says about roasting vegetables. She calls it cooking by instinct. She says, basically, you can roast any vegetable, and it's really all about your nose. First, you turn the oven on to 450 degrees. Slip a big shallow pan in to heat up with the oven. The pan should be large enough so the vegetables can be spread out. You don't want them over one layer deep. You can mix them up. The gold standard of shallow roasting pans is the heavy-duty half-sheet pan. Mix your vegetables by balancing earthy with sweet. For example, cauliflower and turnips with carrots, tart greens with parsnips, Brussels sprouts with yams. Generous amount of onion is essential. For even quicker cooking, thin slice the harder root vegetables like your potatoes. Toss the vegetables with good tasting oil and seasonings. Determine how spices and herbs will taste when mixed together by putting them on the tip of your tongue. If you don't like the mix, try something else. Some dependable combinations are sage, rosemary, and lemon zest, or allspice, cumin, coriander, and chili powder, or minced fresh ginger, soy sauce, and rice vinegar. You allow 30 to 40 minutes of roasting time for soft vegetables like zucchini, peppers, onions, tomatoes, and fruits. Root vegetables may need another 20 or 30 minutes. And you turn those vegetables two or three times during cooking. Use a wooden spatula to scrape up the brown glaze that collects on the bottom of the pan. This is pure flavor, so keep blending it back into the mix. Remember, a few caveats here. If you're using garlic, garlic burns in longer cooking roasts, so add it to the last half hour. Sweet sauces like barbecue ones burn within minutes, so it's best to add them during the last 15 minutes. Vinegar, citrus, and other acids slow down browning. When you use them as seasonings, you may need to brown the vegetables at the end of the cooking by slipping them under the broiler for a few minutes. That's all the best advice I know about roasting vegetables. And roasting vegetables, as I said, is my favorite way to keep tomatoes over the winter. If you would like to see the recipe for tomato pie from Lori Colwin, it will be on the UPR website for the Zesty Garden. Thanks for listening to me, and I'll see you next time. This is Nancy Williams for the Zesty Garden.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the 2015 Zion Canyon Music Festival, September 25th and 26th, starting at 3 p.m., offering microbrews, wines, and food. More at zioncanyonmusicfestival.com. And the Utah State University Alumni Association, readying students for their careers through alumni mentorships and internship opportunities. Information at usu.edu/alumni.
You're listening to KCEU Price, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.